Good morning. Welcome. Glad you're with us. If you're with us for the first time or joining us this morning, we welcome you. Thank you for joining us. I'm thankful to have some of my family here today as we celebrated my little cousin's wedding in Columbus last night. And in particular, I have my grandfather here. He is now living in Maryville, Tennessee, with his bride, or as they would say, Merville. But he is a true Buckeye. In fact, I can see his little Ohio State logo on his shirt this morning. And so glad he's back in the Buckeye State. A few years ago, he came to hear me preach, or he's visiting me, and I happened to be preaching that Sunday. And when I was in Little Rock, Arkansas, serving as a youth minister, and during that Sunday, I was teaching from the text Hebrews 12, 1 through 2. And in that text, the writer talks about a great cloud of witnesses. So I was wanting to illustrate what a cloud of witnesses looks like. Like there's just a huge crowd that's almost blurry. You don't see the faces. It's just this cloud of witnesses. And so I looked up some of the biggest stadiums in the world, and I was going to pop up a picture of one of the stadiums. Well, it just so happened to find out that Michigan Stadium in Ann Arbor, Michigan, was like the second biggest stadium in the world. And so I pop up a picture of Michigan Stadium there on the PowerPoint to illustrate a great cloud of witnesses. And I tell you what, I thought my grandpa was going to disown me after that. He could not believe I would throw Michigan up on the screen for all to see. But he's here again to hear me, and he very much viewed me as a prodigal or lost son. But alas, the lost son has returned. I'm back in the Buckeye State. So this morning, we're continuing this series in Luke 15, and we're going to talk about the lost son, the prodigal son. And we talked about this idea of lostness last week, and we realized that from the outside world, that can be viewed as a term that's offensive, because we're saying, here's the way you should go. But as we think about lostness, that's not quite how we think about it, and that's not how we should think about it. Rather than it being a term of judgment, we ought to view it as a term of compassionate. We're saying we have a heart for others. We believe that God has created the world, and that Jesus is his son, has established his kingdom, has died for us, and we want people to know him. And Jesus himself, as Chad read for us in the scripture reading, Jesus said, I come to seek and save the lost. And that's meant to elicit compassion, not judgment. And as Jesus used the term lost, what he meant by that is that they're disconnected from the Father. And sort of the definition we started working with last week on what we mean by lost from the Christian story perspective is that to be lost is to be disconnected from the Creator in the way of life he intended for you. And we're going through this series and talking about that. But what's really interesting about that is sometimes when we think lost, we think of people outside of the church. But what's really interesting about this, as we'll see sort of next week as well, get more into this theme, but more often than not, when you hear the term lost in Scripture, it's actually talking about church people. It was talking about people who were living for God or at one time were living for God. It wasn't talking about the Gentiles. It's talking about the people of God. And we need to keep that in mind. Because when we come to the story that we come to, we're talking about people who were considered the people of God, people of the Old Testament, the Jews. And as we establish some context for the parable this morning, we look back at the scenario we saw last week where Jesus is teaching tax collectors and sinners, by the way, who weren't Gentiles, they were the people of God, who had wandered off. And for a first century Jew, right, that these were truly lost people as they thought about tax collectors and sinners. Tax collectors, those who had sold themselves to the Romans, were working for the Romans to charge the Jews high taxes and to take some off of that to line their own pockets. And then the sinners who were involved in some sort of immoral, at least in an immoral behavior or an immoral occupation. And so they were all gathered around to hear Jesus. And you have this beautiful scene where tax collectors and sinners were comfortable with Jesus. They wanted to hear from Jesus. They trusted Jesus. But it wasn't beautiful to everybody, because what we find out in verse 2, but the Pharisees and the teachers, who were the religious elite, they were the leaders at that time. They muttered, "This man welcomes sinners and eats with them." And this is a theme throughout the book of Luke. Over and over again, Jesus is sitting down at a table with people that the religious elite thought he shouldn't be sitting with, hanging out with the wrong crowd. And in fact, in Luke chapter 19, which Chad read for us, you have the story of Zacchaeus, which is a perfect illustration of what we're going to talk about today. Or I should say, what we're going to talk about today is an illustration of what happened in the life of Zacchaeus. As Zacchaeus was one of these tax collectors. Perhaps he was there among that crowd, perhaps not. But the idea is he's coming from the same group that Jesus was constantly being criticized for hanging out with. Yet Jesus called him home and Zacchaeus returned. In that moment, Jesus also took criticism from this very same group of the religious elite. And so what Jesus did is that, like he often did, he used this scenario that we've read here in Luke chapter 15, he used it as an opportunity to teach. And he told these parables, these stories, as a way to open up the minds of those who were listening. Specifically, he didn't tell these parables in order to teach the tax collectors and sinners. He used these parables to teach the religious elite, who should have known these things already, but Jesus was calling them back to the heart of God. And last week we talked about the story Jesus tells about the lost sheep and lost coin. And now we come to the story of the prodigal son, or the lost son. And just the way that we talk about it, Scripture doesn't talk about it in that sense, that it's the story of the lost son or the prodigal son. But instead, we find out that it's a story about two sons. As we see here in Luke chapter 15 and verse 11, it says, Jesus continued, "There was a man who had two sons." And next week, Nick is going to continue on to the last part of the story where he talks about the older son. Nick Hutchins, our student minister, will preach next week and talk about that side of the story. But today we'll focus on the younger son, the first of the two that come up in Jesus' story. And Jesus goes on, he says, "The younger one came to his father. He said to his father, 'Father, give me my share of the estate.'" And that should sound odd to us, because today you don't get your inheritance until after your parents pass away. And by the way, it wasn't any different in the first century, right? It was a very odd thing for him to come to his father and demand his inheritance before his father was even close to having died. It was a radical and a disrespectful thing for the younger son to ask for. He was basically saying to the father, "I wish you were dead. Give me inheritance." Excuse me. "Give me my inheritance." In other words, he's saying, "You're dead to me. Give me what is mine." Excuse me. And his father could have reacted in a lot of different ways to that. In fact, I want to ask you, how would you react if you had a son or a daughter come to you and to demand their inheritance in this way and to say, "I'm done with you, give me what is mine, I want to go on"? How would you react to that? Can't imagine many of us would handle it with much grace. We'd be frustrated. But the father could have handled it in numerous ways. He could have perhaps, compromised with the son and said, "Listen, if your current allowance isn't enough for you, I can give you more. If you're in need of more money or need of more resources, let me give that to you." The father could have done that. Or the father could have sort of put the son on a probationary period and said, "Let me give you half of it now. And once you've shown you're able to be responsible with it, or once he's passed on, the father's passed on, then he gets the rest of it." Or the father could have reacted probably like a lot of us would, could have reacted with anger, right? "How disrespectful for you to say, you know, I'm dead to you, right? How dare you demand your inheritance?" And lashed out in anger. Or, similar to that, he could have disgraced his son and says, he could have said, "You are no longer part of this family. You have disgraced our family." Right? All of those were options. Perhaps maybe the first two wouldn't have been an option in their cultural moment at that time. The last two were. But what the father does is something really surprising. He listens to the son, and he gives his son the inheritance. He gives it. He lets him go. He doesn't stop him from going. He doesn't You can maybe call the Father an enabler in that sense, that he gives an inheritance, which, by the way, it's not like it was sitting in a bank account and the Father wrote a check and said, here you go. This would have required the Father to sell off property, to sell off part of his herds, part of the, or whatever their line of work was, it would to sell part of their business, right? This was a big deal for the son to demand the inheritance. It affected the family greatly. According to the Old Testament law, the older son would get 2/3 of the inheritance and the younger son would get perhaps 1/4. And so for them to divide their property in that way in order to be able to give the son what he was demanding was a big deal. But that's what the father does. The father doesn't keep him from going, but instead the text says the father divided his property between them. And the father allows the son to do what he wanted. And what the son ultimately wanted was distance from the father. He wanted to be away from the father. He was giving up his father's way of living and saying, I'm going to go out on my own to live life as I see fit, rather than to live with you and to be with you. And that's what he got. The resources were merely a way to get the distance from the father. It was merely to pay for the bill for him to get away and establish his own life. But that's what the son did. He cashes the property out and he goes, we're told, into a distant land. It says not long after that, the younger son got together all that he had and set off for a distant country and there squandered his wealth in wild living. And there's much emphasis on the distant country. Because the emphasis of the story is, again, what the son really wanted is to be away from the father. He wanted separation from his father. We're not told why, but we're just told there's an inclination in him that he wanted to be away from the father, separate from the father's way of living. He wanted disconnection from the father and wanted to go off and to establish his own life. And so he goes off into a distant country. Right? This isn't to a neighboring village. This isn't to the neighboring state. He went off to a distant place, perhaps as far as he could possibly get from his father and from his family. And we're told, of course, this young man, you can kind of understand the trajectory of the story. It's not like he's going to go and put all this money into investment accounts and to use it wisely. You can tell where this is going. It says he squandered all of his wealth in wild living, spends it all. His parents sold all that they had, or sold all their land so that they could give him his part of his inheritance, or at least a large part of their land to give him his inheritance, and he spends it on his own desires and his own wants, and in a way in which the text says he squandered it, he wasted it, just went out and spent it, wasted it. Got nothing back in return, nothing to bring to the table, but instead he squandered it. As we look at this story, we're meant to see how far the son has gone in order to distance himself from the father. We're meant to see sort of the pain that goes along with leaving home in such a way. And as we think modernly about leaving home, it's not always necessarily a bad thing. We sort of see leaving home as a launching point. It's a good thing as you're going out to continue to do good things in the name of your family. So home is sort of a launching point in our modern society. But for them, it wasn't. For you to leave home was a big deal. It signaled disconnection and leaving family behind. And what we're meant to see in this story is the pain that went along with that. And the sort of the squandering that took place is him squandering his inheritance, squandering the life his father has given him. But the story isn't just imaginary, because in one way or another, what I think we're meant to see in the story, at least at this portion of the story, the story has so many elements to it, but at this portion of the story, I think we're meant to see that in one way or another, we have all left home. In fact, that's really sort of the Christian story about humanity, is that at one point or another, when we've come to our point of understanding in our life, that in various ways, we leave home. We disconnect ourselves, not talking about our physical parents, but we disconnect ourselves from the Creator who created us when we choose that our way is better than His way. No matter how big or how small, we take steps away from the Father. And leaving home is much more than a simple choice, right, to go set our own way. But it's actually a denying of our family identity, denying of our values, denying in our context of the one who has created us. Henry Nouwen, who we've kind of looked at some during the series, he says, leaving home then, as he's looking at this parable, this story, is much more than a historical event bound in time and place, right? This is a parable, it's a story. But leaving home, and it's more than just a moment where you can say, okay, I left home at this point. But we're thinking spiritually, those moments where we have gotten off the good path. It says instead, it is a denial of the spiritual reality that I belong to God with every part of my being. And I think that that can be done consciously and unconsciously. It's not as if every moment when we were to leave home, we say, you know, I don't believe in God anymore. I'm going off to live my own way. I don't care anymore. I think it's rarely ever that clear cut. But it's usually we've taken a few steps here and a few steps there, and we've separated or created distance and have separated ourselves from God. And I can already hear some of us thinking in our minds, because I've been there too, where you say, well, I don't really have a story. You know, I remember growing up and being in high school, talking with other people of faith, and them talking about these great stories, their testimonies, and really powerful stories. And someone would ask me, well, what's your testimony? What's your story? And I remember thinking, I don't really have a story. Okay, I grew up in church, and I've always been connected. But where I would push back on all of us who might be thinking that is when we think we don't have a story, we're perhaps at the deepest part of the story still. And I think that's part of what Jesus is saying as he's pointing the Pharisees and the teachers to this young man who's gone off and squandered his wealth, and they're thinking, you know, we haven't left home, we've not done this and that, while this young son has gone off and squandered his wealth like the tax collectors and sinners. But I think Jesus is pointing them back and saying, yes, you do have a story. Right? Even if you haven't gone to the far, far distant country, we've all taken steps that have disconnected us from our Creator at times. Henry Nouwen says you can see this in sort of the imperfections and brokenness of our everyday life. He says anger, resentment, jealousy, desire for revenge, lust, greed, antagonisms, and rivalries, which, by the way, we all struggle with at some level. He says, these are all the obvious signs that I have left home. And he continues on as he paints his own experience. And he's a religious person, mind you. And he continues on, he says, and without realizing it, I find myself brooding over someone else's success, my own loneliness, and the way the world abuses me. And despite my own conscious intentions, I often catch myself daydreaming about becoming rich, powerful, and very famous. And the point here is this, that although there may not be this huge story that we might think about, because, or for whatever reason, we have some sort of bias around what that means, the reality is we all have moments in life where we take steps from God. And as Henry Nouwen would point out, as we go throughout life, even the most seasoned Christian has these moments where they take steps away from God to the far country, creating distance between them and the Father. And that's not to discourage us, but that's to call us into the story and to say, we can relate to the younger son. We have all been in the same, on the same path as the younger son to some extent or another. And it's important for us to see that. And he continued on, he says, and all these mental games reveal to me the fragility of my faith, that I am the beloved one of whom God's favor rests, that I'm loved by God, and I'm so afraid of being disliked, blamed, put aside, passed over, ignored, persecuted, and killed, I'm constantly developing strategies to defend myself and therefore assure myself of the love I think I need and deserve. And that's ultimately what taking steps away from God look like. That's ultimately what happens in the garden where Adam and Eve take some steps away from God. What's happening in that moment is that they're searching for something that they don't think God can offer them. They're searching for love. They're searching for a way of life. And here's what Henry Nouwen says about all of this, which I think is a powerful thought. He says, I am the prodigal son. Every time I search for unconditional love, where it cannot be found. And this doesn't always happen in big, monumental ways, but it happens one step at a time where we're searching for more, searching for love in our own way, and we end up walking away from the Father. Now, what we see here with the Son is that this is what he's doing. And what he finds out, ultimately, is that this is an empty path. That it ultimately does not bring him what he thinks it's going to bring him. It doesn't provide the love he thinks he's going to find. It doesn't provide the life he thinks he's going to find. But instead, it says, after he had spent everything, there was a severe famine in that whole country, and he began to be in need. Right? He'd squandered everything. He lived foolishly, spent all that he had, and now there's a famine. And so now there was no extra resources in that country in order to provide for people who have squandered their wealth. It says, so he went and he hired himself. He became desperate. So he hired himself to a citizen of that country who sent him to his fields to feed pigs. And he was so hungry that he longed to fill his stomach with the pods that the pigs were eating. But no one gave him anything. What we see here is that the young man comes to rock bottom. For a first century Jew, part of their identity was one, circumcision, but then two, it was their diet and how they didn't eat certain things, and one of those big things, which would have included pigs, swine. And so, as you would imagine, there weren't very many Jewish pig farmers because of this. They were considered unclean. In fact, one of the greatest catastrophes in the early BC era, before coming up into the change of the century, the birth of Christ, was when a pig was sacrificed on the altar by an enemy. And that was considered just the worst insult that there could possibly be because of how pigs and swine were viewed. And so for the young man to come and to align himself with a Gentile pig farmer, it was just the lowest of the lows. And all the Jews would have understood that this was as low as you could go, that you would even long to eat the food that pigs do because there was nothing else that you could have. And you were literally starving to death, that this was the lowest of the lows. And so, in other words, that this was the young man's rock bottom. Now, as we think about rock bottom, perhaps our steps from God take us to a point where it's our rock bottom. It's a moment where we realize we can't go any lower than here. Now, I've often heard it said that the thing about rock bottom is that you can only go up from there. And I think there's some truth to that. However, I would qualify that statement by saying this, that in order to go up from there, you have to realize you're at rock bottom. You have to have the eyes to see that this is as bad as it gets. And if we do, then there's a way forward. And for the young man, he was at his rock bottom. And so he needed to see where he was and what he had left behind. Henry Nouwen says it like this. He says, only when we have the courage to explore in depth what it means to leave home, to understand what it means to take steps away from our Father, he says, can I come to a true understanding of the return. And so the young man does that. He realizes the depths of his rock bottom. He realizes the depths of the fact that he has left home and what that means for his life now. And what he has searched out has brought him emptiness. And he says, and when he came, the text says, when he came to his senses, he looked up and he realized, saw where he had ended up, and realized this was not what he was aiming for. This was not what he thought life apart from the Father would look like. So when he came to his senses, and he began to reason, he said, how many of my father's hired servants have food to spare? And here I'm starving to death. He said, even the workers at my father's house, right there, they have food everywhere. They have an abundance of food. And he's reflecting on the fact that his father's house was a place of abundance. Why did I leave that behind? He said, there's food to spare. And so he made a plan. He said, I'm going to set out and go back to my father. But he knows if he goes back to the father, in their culture and in our culture, that may not end very well. You've spent the inheritance. You've squandered it. It's gone. You've demanded your father give it to you and that you told him, I wish you were dead. This isn't going to go very well. And so he comes up with this plan. First, he's going to confess his sin. He's going to go to the father and say, Father, I have sinned against heaven and against you. And here's where the plan kind of comes in. He says, and I'm no longer worthy to be called your son. So here's the plan. So since I can't be your son, just make me like one of your hired servants. And the son really sees this as his rescue. And he's not thinking, let me go back into my father's love. He's thinking, let me just be one of the servants so that I have bread to spare, just so I can survive. Can I come back into your house? I'm not worthy to be your son. And I think that's probably how we all would react in that situation, is you're really coming, bowing yourself down in mercy in this situation. Like, that's the plan. It says, so he put the plan together and says, so he got up and he went to his father. He decided he would return. However, he would no longer return as a son, but instead as a slave. And I can just imagine what's going through this young man's mind as he's returning to the father after having declared he wished his father was dead, demanded his inheritance, and then squandered it off. Now he's got this plan. I can just imagine going on this long journey. And I know how I would be. I would be playing that scenario over and over in my head, thinking, how is my father going to react to this request for him to take me back in? What's this going to look like? This is like my last chance for survival. What's it going to look like? And he has that speech that he's created. You know, Father, I've sinned against you. I'm no longer your son, but take me as a servant. And I can just imagine him sort of repeating that to himself as he's walking along the road, repeating it to himself over and over, rehearsing what that conversation is going to look like so that it can go well. And that just maybe he can be received back by his father as a servant. But what happens in the story is totally radical and totally unlike anything they would have expected to hear. It says, but while the son was still a long way off, sort of in the distance, a long way off, his father saw him and was filled for compassion for him. It was almost like the father was like looking out the window, just waiting every day, just waiting for his son to return. That a long distance off, he's able to look and he knows the silhouette of his son off in the distance. And it says, as soon as he saw him, the text says that he ran to his son, threw his arms around him and kissed him. And I can only imagine that the son was totally thrown off by this. He expected his father to throw arms, but he didn't quite expect it to happen like this. He wasn't expecting a hug. He wasn't expecting to throw his arms around his neck and to kiss him and to welcome him back. And the son, surely, you know, he had probably memorized it to a T, rehearsed it over and over again. Even though he's thrown off by this entire situation, he still is able to go back to that memorized speech. And he says, Father, I've sinned against heaven and against you. I'm no longer worthy to be called your son. And he's about to get to his proposal and to get to where he was going with the whole thing, saying, I'm going to be your servant. But the father doesn't even allow him to get to that point. But the father interrupts him. And the father quickly, almost just ignores what the son's about to say. And the father starts calling his servants together. He says, quick, quick, bring the best robe and put it on him. Put a ring on his finger and sandals on his feet. And he says, bring the fatted calf and kill it. Let's have a feast and celebrate it. You see, all of these were signs of sonship, not of servanthood. The father puts his best robe, you know, kind of think of pictures of Joseph receiving the robe from his father, put a ring. A ring was a symbol of authority, of sonship. A signet ring in the early first century meant that you were the son and you had the authority and the privileges that went along with that. And then sandals were put on his feet, which at that time would have signified that you're part of the family, that you're taken care of. Only servants at the time would have gone barefooted. And so the whole idea here is that the father doesn't even listen to his request that he can be a servant, but receives him with open arms as a son and restores him to his place in the family, which was radical. And they begin to celebrate over this. And surely the servants were sort of confused by this. They didn't expect the father to react this way. And the father explains, for this son, not servant, not prodigal son, not lost son, but my son, this son of mine was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found. Does that resonate with you? Have you ever felt dead and were brought alive again? Have you ever felt lost and felt that feeling of being found? That this was a time of celebration. It was a time of joy. Ultimately, we believe that that's what we experience when we come back to the Father, are received in His open arms, and we pledge allegiance to Jesus as King. And this was a time of celebration. It was a season, a moment for celebration. But as we'll see, not everyone felt that way. as we'll see next week. But as we think about this story this morning and what we sort of can draw from it, we realize that this is just a story. It's just that. It's a parable. I don't know that we need to deduce that this was a historic thing. It's Jesus telling a story to illustrate what God is like. And Jesus was ultimately modeling what God was like, as he was God in the flesh. And as he was teaching the Pharisees and the religious elite, that's who the story was targeted to. They had lost sight of the fact that God's heart was for his people, that God's heart was for the lost, that God wanted all people to come to him so that he could be in relationship with them. And even today, we as the church, we can lose sight of that. Right, perhaps as we think about this story, we don't think of, perhaps some people, they see church as more of a judgmental place, a place that doesn't welcome people who aren't like them. And I have to say, to some extent, I agree with that because I've been there too, and I've been that judgmental person. And what we need to see, though, is that this parable is truly at the heart of the good news about Jesus, that this is the heart of the gospel, that this is God's heart. And what Jesus telling this story to the Pharisees and the religious elite, and for Jesus telling the story with the tax collectors and sinners in his presence as well, he was telling the story to show them that he expected this to be part of the life and at the heart of every disciple that decides to follow him. But we see in the story, it's a powerful message that no matter whether we have a big story or a story where we've taken steps here and there that have harmed our relationship with God, what we learn from this story is no matter how far we have distanced ourselves from God, Jesus' message is this, that we are always welcome home. And perhaps most powerful of all in this story is that we don't need to convince God to take us back in. Yet we try to, right? We try to say the right things. We try to do the right things in order in our minds to convince God that we're worthy enough to be a part of his family, worthy enough to sit at the table. However, as we see in the story, God will cut us off and he will give us the sandals, give us the robe, give us the ring, and call us his beloved sons and daughters once again. And so maybe that's not the image of God that we have. Perhaps we've been given a different image of God, right? Perhaps, as I've talked about before, the image of God I've had, that God was angry, that he was constantly judging us, constantly waiting for us to mess up. Or maybe you had an image of God where God's sort of distant, uninvolved, doesn't really care about human affairs, doesn't care about our lives. What we see in the story is that that is not the image of God that Jesus was presenting. Instead, he has an image of God who's waiting, who's looking out in the distance, waiting for us to take a step back towards him. Is that we have an image of God, a God who is waiting for us. And the question this morning, perhaps you've wondered, perhaps you've gone to the far country, or perhaps you've just taken a step in the wrong direction. The question this morning for you to ask yourself is, will you return home? Because once you do and you take that step in the right direction, God's going to run out and to greet you and to welcome you back as a son and daughter of God. If you have any need, you'd like to respond to the gospel today, to pledge allegiance to Jesus as your king, or you just want to take a step back, be received by God this morning through the prayer of your brothers and sisters here at Northeast, we hope you'll come as we stand and while we sing.